it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
I'm a Baltimore-based journalist who really has focused over the past six or so years on policing, activism, and sort of the underground economy. I was previously at the Baltimore City Paper, where I did kind of every job possible. You would do it in alt-weekly. And then before that, I was at Spin Magazine, where I was covering sort of hip-hop and politics. And so the sort of through line to a lot of that is police, because covering hip-hop and the sort of racism surrounding, you know, the perception of hip hop. There's lots of police harassment of rappers. I wrote some pieces about the rapper Lil Boozy back in 2011 when he was sort of being used. Lyrics were being used against him. He was charged with a murder. You see this all the time now. There's a lot of other rappers that have endured this. So I kind of came to policing through culture writing. I was also covering a lot of nightlife, both sort of club music and club culture in Baltimore, and also, like, you know, punk and basement shows and DIY shows, which are often being raided by the police. So I kind of had this weird started as kind of a culture journalist and reporter that kept bumping into police issues, and then always had my own sort of perceptions of police coming from Baltimore. I was born in Baltimore. I was kind of always taught to dislike and distrust the police. So those things all kind of came together in 2014, because there was this kind of big story of this rapper here named Young Moose, who was being harassed by a police officer who was using his lyrics and his music videos for probable cause, and saying, hey, look in this video, he's holding a gun, therefore he's violating probation. Like, outrageous. So we wrote about that just because it was an interesting First Amendment story. And then from there, kind of kept covering policing, covered the Baltimore uprising in Baltimore really heavily, especially focused on activists in the community. Started to hear more about policing and not just like sort of anecdotal stories. We started to be given information and sort of got on this kind of Baltimore cops beat. Then finally, in 2017, one day, you know, early in the morning, I get a text message, and kind of I think a bunch of reporters got it. And there was a bunch of police officers going to be indicted for a bunch of crimes, basically conspiracy and racketeering, you know, like they're the mob. And among these seven officers was this officer Herschel, who I'd reported about harassing a rapper. So that was kind of my entryway into this specific scandal, because I happened to know one of the seven officers that was charged that day for, you know, they were charged with stealing overtime, violating people's rights. There's accusation of planting evidence. They also were stealing drugs and redealing them, stealing cash, and lots of other stuff. And so it turned out that there was this way bigger story than just this one cop harassing this one guy that I kind of missed. And then me and my co-writer on the book, who was also at City Paper at the time, Baynard Woods, we just started really digging into this case and talking to more people and started connecting dots, you know, pieces of information that we knew here or there, and started to see that there was a big, really interesting story that kind of confirmed what I'd been hearing when I'd been reporting, that cops are a gang, that you can't trust them, that they plant stuff on you, that they put drugs on you, that they steal from you, all that kind of stuff you kind of know. But to see it in a federal indictment by Donald Trump's Department of Justice, nonetheless, was sort of shocking, and sort of gave us the energy to really push this push it on a bigger level and really dig into it.
When did you work at Spin?
So I was at Spin from 2011 to early 2014 for those years. So I worked for the magazine and then the website, mostly kind of doing hip hop blogging, but really focusing on stories about rappers and their come up, which often involved harassment and incarceration and things like that. And it sort of got me understanding that language and understanding that world a little more than I did as kind of a white guy from Baltimore, kind of understood the problems with police and had friends or family that had been messed with by police, but really seeing on a different level that started with like sort of
hearing about what rappers all over the country were talking about, whether they're in Baton Rouge or Huntsville, Alabama or Los Angeles. They had really similar stories about policing.
Well, just for people that are listening to this, that maybe they only know a little bit about Baltimore, the city, you know, Tupac lived there for a while. The Wire is supposedly based, you know, on the city. I know Red Emma's is there. You know, 20 years ago, there was pretty vibrant anarchist scene. Like, I know, I think NEFAC had a couple chapters there. I think there was a really good punk band, Apolitical, that was based out of there. But what do people need to know about the city itself, the police and the people there, that kind of goes into the context of the book and what we'll be talking about?
But yeah, I mean, there, you kind of captured some of the big things. Yeah, Tupac spent some formative years here. Shout out to Red Emma's, you know, great bookstore. It's really been supportive of the book. And yeah, The Wire, which sort of hangs over all conversations of Baltimore, especially crime stories. So including our book, some people have kind of framed this book as like another season of The Wire or whatever, where my sense is I don't think that The Wire would be willing to handle cops this corrupt, but I could be wrong. But what you really need to know about Baltimore is sort of that image of, let's just, you know, start with The Wire, sort of this bombed out, you know, place where there's crime, it's super dysfunctional. Those things are all true, but there's a ton of wealth here, and that wealth is then, like all wealth, protected by the police in a city that's deeply segregated, that's almost apartheid-like city. That was really language that people started to really feel more comfortable throwing out in 2014, 2015, as police uprisings started to happen. So you have this tension in the city between a white sort of business class or petty bourgeoisie that wants to be protected, that's then surrounded on the east and west sides by black Baltimore that have been divested for, you know, more than 100 years, the basics of redlining, and things like that, that prevent black people from owning homes or, you know, moving up in any form, because it originates in Baltimore. That's where redlining starts. So that's sort of all still really imprinted on the city. And when you look at a map of the city, you can really see these segregation lines. So I really bring that up because, A, I want to, and you, as you, if you read the book, you'll see that a lot of these robberies, a lot of these crimes happen in sort of very nice areas. So there's also want to push against this idea that the whole city is full of sort of what you see on The Wire, lots of vacants and things like that. Those all exist, but there's a real like sort of wealth business class that's very opposed to doing anything that might change the city for the better and maintaining the segregated policing.
What do you mean by that? Make the city for the better.
So what you have here is you just have, if you stretch back, you have basically this idea that we have a city that became deindustrialized. You know, both my grandparents, for example, were steel workers. That becomes deindustrialized. They don't bring in more jobs into the 80s. The underground economy takes over. That widens the sort of disparity. Then what happens with all cities, and it's also sort of neoliberal policies that took over the city of just like, hey, bring in developers, bring in a new sports stadium, you know, open up this place to tourists. And then the motivation becomes to, you know, you want to push off the crime and you want to sort of segregate people, especially black people, in a city that's at the time was about 66% black, is now about 62, but it's a majority black city. So you want to try to appeal to these outsiders, and you do that by divesting and pushing away and preventing people and working people from being a major part of the city or being part of the conversation. And so attempts to sort of change that or invest in black Baltimore have been crushed every time, because it's just not in the business class's interest. And what you really see is into the 2000s is the police here further sort of pushing that. The one thing I really focus on is the scope of our book is really 2016, 2017. But these police officers, most of them started in the early 2000s. In the early 2000s in Baltimore, a city of about a little over 600,000, the police were arresting about 100,000 to 120,000 people a year. That's a lot of people. That's a crazy amount of people. Like, when we had the book fact checked, the fact checker circled that number. It was like, wanted to make sure it was accurate. I had to be like, yes. So you have this early period where they're just arresting everybody, all sort of nuisance crimes, all imported from New York's sort of way they quote unquote cleaned up New York. And so these kind of cleanup processes that further create a racial divide and don't provide any jobs or even places for people to be, because then you start to do things that you see in cities where, you know, you start closing down rec centers and things like that. Any place where they perceive as potentially where people of color and working people gather, they get rid of those things. So that was a real concerted effort in Baltimore that sort of peaked in the early 2000s, but was all a way to sort of separate and segregate the working people and the black people from the business class. And you see just a stark example of that with how the city's policed. You can go to one part of the city and see, you know, open containers because it's a white sort of frat bro part of the city. You make it to another part of the city and cops are like enforcing jaywalking in open container. And so you have this tension between a white business class, a white sort of bourgeoisie that can do whatever they want because they bring in the money supposedly, and decades of people that have been really had their jobs taken away and they've only been given an underground economy. I mean, even Anthony Batts, one of the police commissioners of Baltimore, you know, was previously commissioner in the Bay Area. He noted that if the underground economy were to go away tomorrow, Baltimore would have a recession, which that was a really interesting thing for even a cop to admit to. That's how embedded in this city the drug economy, especially heroin, has become since the 80s as the sort of deindustrialization of the city really became a rapid thing that, you know, pushed a lot of people out of jobs.
One other overarching question kind of before we start to get into the book. What is the role of the police in all this? I mean, we're talking about big stuff, you know, deindustrialization, you know, neoliberal politics and economics, gentrification, you know, the hollowing out of urban cores, you know, resegregation, you know, the police as a political entity, what is their role in this? Because a lot of times people just paint the police as this apolitical entity that's just there to enforce the laws and they have no role in all this. Through the decades, how have they played an active role in all this stuff coming to be?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, one place to start would be a lot of the jobs go away. And so you can even, and then your job is often, do you want to become a cop or do you want to become involved in the underground economy? That becomes a real tension between white working class and black working class people in the city, is there's no more jobs. So the police becomes more appealing. So there's that kind of tension. As you'll see in this book, these officers then sort of collapse that binary, both black and white cops who then became cops but were also working in the underground economy and dealing and stealing drugs. On a more broader level, what you just see is that as white flight and things tied to these big picture issues happen, a lot of white folks move out of the city. They move to either Pennsylvania, which isn't that far away, like York, Pennsylvania is maybe a 30-minute drive from Baltimore, for example, or they move to Baltimore County, which has been mostly white and working class. And then they are police officers that then aren't living in the city, and then they start to have the vision of the sort of racist countyite of the city. And so there's also a tension there where police officers start to be enforcing a sort of especially like developers' vision of the city in which you're just trying to contain crime, contain it to certain areas. Like, it's not when a homicide happens in the city that everyone freaks out. It's when a homicide happens in certain areas. And what happens is that kind of crime becomes really politicized.
This has happened recently a lot with the opioid crisis, where they'll be like, well, the drugs are, you know, the pills are coming from, you know, the black inner cities and they're flooding into the white suburbs is the discourse.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's like an earlier version of that. And also, there is a lot of that in Baltimore, including a heroin crew that's involved with one of the cops in the book. Their main sort of clientele was white folks from the county coming in to buy dope. We can get into that more later, but that's kind of a good example of like vilifying the city, which, again, I hate to, you know, Trump's just an easy example, but Trump is really pushing this in such a more overt way than in the past Republicans or even Democrats have done it, of like framing the suburbs as the certain way. And so you have police starting to enforce these ideas and really be encouraged to do unconstitutional policing to do this. Again, the most overt examples being, you know, sort of looking for reasons to arrest people, kind of nuisance crimes. So that's kind of the model of policing that sort of took over in Baltimore into the 2000s. So you have police sort of do, I mean, in a way, this is obvious stuff for, especially for your listeners, I think, like police protect property and they protect the class, you know, certain classes. But I think the specific segregation of the city and the desperation that happens really enabled police to really work as like, we occupy parts of the city and we prevent people from going to other parts of the city. And you see this a lot with where just, I mean, you could drive, it's a small city too. You can drive across the whole city in probably 30 minutes. You can just see how police operate in one part of the city or not. And this is also tied to the tension between a high crime rate and high homicide rate the city has always had, which also gets politicized because you'll see, much like you now see, again, on a national level, crime being sort of politicized example of, like, how we need to do more, how we need to, you know, we need more police, or we need, you know, the idea that when this stuff, you know, Baltimore's basically had a homicide problem for decades, but the argument is always the same. We need more police. We need police to do more. They need to have a longer leash to violate people's rights to arrest the bad guys and things like that. And so no matter what happens in this city, that police keep getting more money as less, more and more things get less money. You know, our police department gets about $550 million every year in a city that doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of money for schools and things like that. And that number just keeps rising. So no matter what the where the violence is, where the crime is, there's still this belief if you just keep piling more money on the police, they can, you know, they can stop it, or, you know, and then they use their inability to stop it to get more money. And that's kind of been the hustle, I think, at least since the 90s in Baltimore when it comes to policing.
Yeah, that's a really good point you bring up about policing people's movements. I think that's key, and we often forget about that. I mean, so many examples of, you know, people being killed are examples of, you know, people being in places, quote, they're not supposed to be, or different neighborhoods, or people passing through and then getting pulled over. But that's a really good point you bring up. But, yeah, I feel like we could talk about this stuff all day, but let's get into the book so we can continue forward. So tell us about, you know, you mentioned you got the text and you heard about this case. How did you get into writing the book?
Yeah, so yeah, first of all, I really appreciate some of those big picture questions in the beginning, because sometimes there's a way in which one can dig into the story. It's just a crazy, trashy police scandal. And it is that, don't get me wrong, but it has major implications. I really appreciate being in a frame like, this is the world that these dirty cops enter. So what happened was, like I said, we kind of had, me and my co-writer Boehner, who have been doing reporting together, we're sort of had this a little bit of this moment of like, well, we missed the bigger story here. We focused on one cop harassing one person, when in fact this was seven cops that were all indicted together that were harassing dozens of people every night. You know, they those testified during the trial for two of the officers who pled not guilty to these crimes, that they would often stop up to 50 people unconstitutionally a night, stop them, search their pockets, steal their drugs, arrest them if they had a gun, or steal their cash. So what happened was we continued to be interested in the story and followed it. There's another officer was indicted about 6 or so months later. So we kind of saw that it was big. You also kept hearing more and more, stories and cops, and you'd hear people that we talked to, you know, sources or people I've reported on reaching out and seeing those cops' faces on the television and being like, those guys did this to me. So we sort of started to accrue anecdotes, but that wasn't really enough. You know, and then into end of 2017, so, you know, they were indicted in March of 2017. In November of 2017, a police officer was shot in the head who was supposed to testify against these cops. This obviously seemed to us like a hit of some kind, and that's what we're hearing from the community. The official version has been this officer committed suicide, but there's never been – it's still being investigated years later, which is – so the story kept getting bigger now, because now we not only have indicted officers, we have a cop that's been killed either because of his involvement or perhaps because he was going to talk. Well, maybe you never know. And then into early 2018 – two of the officers decided not to plead guilty. So again, these officers were charged with basically racketeering conspiracy, like a mafia, like the mafia or a gang, dealing drugs, stealing cash, stealing drugs, lying about a ton of overtime, and just like sort of constant violation of people's rights and robbery. They were charged with robbery because they're police officers, so they're always armed. Therefore, their illegal actions count as robbery, not just theft. Anyway, two of the officers decided to plead not guilty and go to trial, which was great for us in terms of reporters, and for the city, I think, in some ways, because then there was a trial, and that was a federal trial. So the officers who pled guilty were testifying against the two officers that didn't plead guilty to kind of get their time down. Co-conspirators were brought in, including a cocaine-dealing bail bondsman that was working with the main cop, Wayne Jenkins, who's kind of the mastermind of this group. And then the stories kept coming and names kept coming out. So you suddenly saw how big it was. And that really intrigued us. And I kind of left court one day. You know, it was a really intense time in court. A lot of people that were victimized by these cops would come in and testify. And then they would, and then sometimes the stories they had were just terrible. And so we had felt that there was a lot to say and a lot to sort of unpack. And we also saw that it wasn't quite being covered in quite the way we wanted it to be covered. So the trial of the two officers revealed that a lot more about the story, both more co-conspirators, more crimes, and named about a dozen other cops as being involved. So it felt big. And at the same time, we felt like the story wasn't getting the coverage it should have gotten. I mean, I think it's arguably one of the biggest police scandals in American history. I mean, in this case, you have three different officers all dealing drugs with different people, and you have planted evidence, you have a conspiracy that goes back at least a decade. It's pretty big, and we were really frustrated how it wasn't a lot of people covering it. And I think that's to do with sort of the mainstream media's like sort of fickleness, you know, because this is early 2017 into 2018. So then Trump becomes the focus, and Black Lives Matter kind of briefly, and police violence kind of took a back seat in the mainstream. And so we really felt like we could tell this story in a book and maybe make it accessible and have a sort of national facing angle that maybe make people understand both the story itself and the people whose lives were really ruined by these cops, but also that it said a lot about the nature of policing itself as sort of, you know, it's that policing, police are a gang. These guys are charged with being a gang, but policing in and of itself is gang-like.
Well, the description for the book reads, this is the story of the Gun Trace Task Force, or GTTF. That's something you'll hear us talk a lot about. A super group of dirty detectives who exploited some of America's greatest problems. Guns, drugs, toxic masculinity, and hypersegregation. So let's get into the story of the book. I mean, you mentioned going to court. Just kind of map out for us. So who were these people? What is the GTTF? And what did they do? We'll kind of like look at this from different angles, but just kind of paint us a picture of what we're talking about. Who are these people?
Sure. So the GTTF, or the Gun Trace Task Force, was kind of a specialized plainclothes police unit. Plainclothes meaning cops that don't wear uniforms, guys that drive around unmarked cars. And you see them in vests. Drug cops is kind of the cliche, or knockers, or jump out boys, as you'll see on TV. The cops that don't sort of even have the illusion of having to be officer friendly. The guys that are prowling around looking for crime. These sort of police parlance is like proactive policing. I mean, you're not even described as proactive policing. It means cops harassing people and looking for crime. This specific unit, was created to respond to gun violence. And the concept was to treat guns the way they were treating drugs. And this is kind of, in a way, a response to sort of liberal and especially then Obama era reforms and a changing and shifting approach to policing, in which, like, hey, we're now going to start to agree that, like, people who use drugs aren't inherently criminal. We need to stop focusing on the drugs. We need to focus on the drug dealers, which is in its own self, I've said, fraud, especially because, like, a lot of people who deal drugs also use drugs. It's not this clear binary of, like, innocent drug, quote unquote, innocent drug users and quote unquote evil drug dealers putting, you know, giving them drugs or whatever. So the idea was to go after guns the way you went after drugs. And that was sort of more a polite or touchy feely version of aggressive policing. Because, hey, we all agree that guns are bad, right? We may agree that drugs are not bad. We all agree guns are bad and we have a violence problem. What you saw was then they just used the tactics of drug cops to go after guns, running up on people, throwing against the wall, searching them, that kind of thing. And at the same time, what this unit was doing was it was investigating sort of violence and gun dealers. Again, that's kind of the drug dealer, gun dealer setup, you know. So they would be trying to trace, say, an illegal gun, which also puts scare quotes around illegal gun because that's another fraught phrase, but illegal gun that they're going after. And then they try to find who gave them that gun and where did that gun come from. And in theory, sort of see where the proliferation of so-called illegal guns is coming and how it's, you know, people are getting guns to then shoot each other. So it was working a gun like a drug case. You arrest a guy with a bag of dope and you're like, hey, who's your plug? And then you go to that plug. Who's your plug? That was the theory. And the idea was that there's a small amount of people that are committing this violence, et cetera, go after them. What this squad did was they used that intelligence to
surveil and then rob these people rather than arrest them. And they often also arrested them, but so they might hear, hey, there's a guy that is dealing a lot of cocaine here, and you know, he has a lot of guns, we've heard from an informant, go arrest them. They would then sort of go to that guy and they'd arrest him for the guns, but then they'd often keep some or all of the drugs or cash. That kind of became their MO. And that was something that these plainclothes squads, like the Gun Trace Task Force, have kind of always been doing. One of the officers during the trial testified that you built trust with fellow cops by stealing. But these guys, under this officer named Wayne Jenkins, is, again, I mentioned, kind of a criminal mastermind. He just sort of sends us into hyperspeed. So now he has a group of seven officers that on the daily are stopping people and searching them for weapons and then finding the weapons, seizing it. And at the same time, he's then also using the intelligence to sort of hit these big targets, what he called monsters, which is where the title comes from.
I want to focus real quick on this issue of cash. I'm just curious, can you explain to listeners how that works? So, I mean, you stop somebody for supposedly under the auspices of like finding a gun or drugs, and they have money. How is it the police get to keep their cash on them, their money? How does that work, and what do they do with the money? What are they supposed to do?
Maryland has especially intense civil forfeiture laws, which means, you know, if you have a certain amount of cash, the police can seize it even if they don't, you know, even if you don't commit a crime or not charged with anything. You have to prove that cash is yours. So on one level, they're able to sort of stop people. Sometimes they had intelligence. Sometimes it was a numbers game. One of the things they like to do is this thing called a door pop, which is they would basically they basically did a mix of stop and frisk with cars. If it's a black motorist, they'd stop him. They'd make up all kinds of lies. Sometimes it would be things like your windows are tinted. Oh, you didn't signal. Things you can't then either have to prove in retrospect. Like you can say your windows aren't tinted, but then they're going to be like, okay, we'll get some guy out here to determine that. Or it would be things like you didn't signal, and you can sit there in your car all night and tell a cop, I did signal, sir, but they're not going to listen if they don't want to. So you use those as a way to get to cars. Then once they got into cars, they would get your license and information. And then if they would search your car, and then they would, if you had anything, they would steal it. And then if they got lucky or they had information, they were following you and they stopped you, they would then use your address to get into your house. And generally so that was kind of the process, is stop someone, see what they have. If they don't have anything, you let them go. If they have anything else, you steal it or you charge them with something. Then you use the information you got from their license or otherwise to get to their home. And then you would go in their home without a warrant early. You'd break in, you'd search it, you'd steal more stuff. Then you'd write a warrant based on what you saw illegally. A judge would sign those warrants unquestioned. Meanwhile, the person's in jail and they're sitting there either saying, you know, I didn't actually get stopped with anything. But then even a public defender or whatever is going to immediately be like, okay, well, they stopped you for a bogus reason, but you had all this, you know, cocaine or whatever, or you had a bunch of cash, whatever. So they sort of used the criminality to for cover. So in a way, they would do the arrest for the department, and then the arrest gave them a way into robbing people. They'd also would plant evidence and stuff like that. There's a few cases where they stop someone unsuccessfully, or they stop someone that they had a good story about, and then they'd kind of throw a gun on the person and be like, hey, we found a gun. And that, you know, it's really hard to fight these things, obviously. The other thing they do is sort of nightly things called door pops, which is drive around these sort of segregated parts of Baltimore that they mentioned, black Baltimore. When they'd see a bunch of young black men gathered, whether it's on a basketball court or at a bus stop or whatever, they'd drive really quick up to them and they'd stop and they'd pop the doors. Everyone would run. Once someone runs, it kind of technically gives you the ability to chase them. But of course, then you just write that in your police report. Oh, you know, we pulled up at this corner and all these men ran. You don't say you sped at them at 30 or 40 miles an hour and popped your door and they ran because of that. Now, again, these are unmarked cars. So in a city like Baltimore with a bunch of violence, you also wouldn't immediately assume a car speeding towards you really fast and popping the door is a cop. So then they're grabbing these anyone who runs and they're searching them. If they find nothing, they let the guy go. If they find a gun, they arrest him for the gun. If they find more than that, they keep it. And then they also had these games where they might arrest you for the gun and the drugs, and then take a percentage of the drugs. Because then if you're in jail and you've been arrested, you're probably not going to say, well, actually, I had more drugs than I was arrested with. You just kind of let it go. And again, these are old classic police. These are classic things that police do. These guys just sort of took it to another level and also had it was a larger group of them, with seven of them that could span more of the city. And they had a really long leash to do this because the city's crime rate sort of allowed a justification for less oversight of police.
The description of the book, it says they stole hundreds of thousands of dollars, which we talked about. They faked video evidence and forged a letter trying to break up the marriage of one of their victims to keep his wife from paying a lawyer. Wow. And a homicide detective was killed the day before he was scheduled to testify against the crooked cops. So, yeah, let's walk through the rest of this stuff and just if maybe giving us a timeline of kind of like how this group evolved. And, you know, we'll kind of get into some of the other stuff a little bit later, but just tell us more about what they did and how, you know, they basically ran this organized crime unit from the police force.
Yeah, so it really begins with this Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, who kind of as soon as he became a police officer in the early 2000s, started robbing. Since we've actually finished the book, unfortunately, we've learned more about the fact that he had a bunch of kind of informants and drug dealers that he was getting paid to give information to as early as 2005, 2006. So he's sort of going to supposed drug corners of the city, and then he's telling these drug dealers, hey, you know, there's going to be a raid tomorrow. Hey, I got this information. Watch out. So he's gathering. So he's working with drug dealers that early. And then he's also working in these squads that are sort of inherently corrupt, these plainclothes squads, because they're constantly in seeing money and drugs and things like that that are easy to steal. You know, if you go into someone's house and you arrest them and they open a drawer and they're a person who deals drugs, so they're operating cash and there's 40 grand in a drawer or whatever, and you flip, you know, five to each of your buddies and you still have a seizure where you arrest someone for being a drug dealer and hand in, you know, 20 grand. It's really easy to do that. So he was doing this. At the same time, as he starts getting more and more drugs, he starts to work with a bail bondsman friend of his who starts dealing the drugs for him. So then he has a way to offshore, move the drugs out once he steals them and make more money. So that's a motivation because he has someone that can steal the drugs. He splits the profits. Jenkins at the same time, because this is important, all the things that make you a good cop would make you a good criminal. We kind of understand the, like, you know, what cops do or what they don't do. And so Jenkins is sort of seen as a super cop. He's making these big arrests. He's making these huge busts. Everyone's either not aware or they're kind of ignoring the fact that, like, he seems to be always at the right place at the right time and that kind of thing. He becomes a sergeant. He gets his own squad. And that squad continues his kind of behavior. And then the Baltimore uprising happens in April 2015 when Freddie Gray is killed by police. Now, this is important because, you know, uprisings, as we're now seeing against police violence, are often then used to encourage police to, you know, be more aggressive. I mean, so we've seen a summer of that, right? And so so there's the fear of the uprising and another uprising happening, or just a sort of frustration with, you know, the negative attitude towards police after they killed someone, that the police sort of encourage cops like Jenkins to go harder and to be more aggressive, in part to, I think, kind of do a version of revenge on the city and its citizens. And another way, as we frame in the book, is a kind of counterinsurgency to squash insurgent attitudes that are the result of an uprising happening. So Jenkins is encouraged to commit more Fourth Amendment violations and go harder after people. And he does that. He's stealing more drugs. And he's getting a lot of sort of success and promotions out of this. The kind of ridiculous story in the book is Jenkins actually looted the looters. So there's, you know, sort of famously on Monday, April 27th in Baltimore, 2015, the uprising kind of became, you know, there was property damage and some burning of buildings. Jenkins rather famously robbed looters of drugs they were looting from pharmacies and then gave them to his drug dealer, who then dealt them himself. So that's kind of a really good example of how the uprising was able to be exploited. But what really happened is the prevailing sense that you now see of cops are embattled and beleaguered and they, you know, they're, no one likes them and we, you know, that's not fair. He really took advantage of that and used that to enforce the sort of reinforce the sort of idea that police need to control the city, control Black Baltimore, who protested. And he took advantage of that. So he gets a series of promotions. And then in 2016, he takes a charge of this gun trace task force and expands his unit. So suddenly he has 7 officers that are all under his control. He's been working with some of them already. He knows a lot of them. They're all plainclothes, so they're all dirty. And that includes a cop, one cop who was working with a heroin crew and helping them deal heroin, and another cop who was kind of a stick-up man who was constantly burglarizing drug dealers' homes and things like that. So as we kind of say, it's a super group of dirty cops. And they kind of run wild over the city for the summer of 2016 into 2017 before they're indicted. And that's the main focus of the book, is this last year of them together. And what you really see is what we said, which is you exploit this idea that, you know, the bad guys are winning, the protesters are winning. You exploit that and you seize more guns, and then the police can put more guns on TV and kind of say, hey, look, our police are doing a great job. Look how many guns we seized yesterday, and that kind of thing. So he kind of had this, you know, he's sort of a super cop and a sociopath criminal at the same time.
We back for everything you owe, no longer oppressed, cause now we overthrow those that placed us in this rotten mess. Now let's agree on strategy and pick our enemies by who stands accused of the abuse, my own kind of pride. Not disregarding what you're thinking, but you must abandon shit, cause once I rip your whole shit, it's sinking. Supreme ideology you claim to hold, claiming that we all drug dealers with empty souls that used to take me to roll, commit to violence in the midst of it that could war. Witnesses left silent to shatter, black talent style thoughts I throw. It remains in your brain, then of course it grows. Maybe even your babies can produce and rhyme. Picture a life where black babies can survive fast by, but we must have hope. Quoting the reverend from the pulpit, refuse to turn the other cheek. We must defeat the evil culprit. Lace me with words of destruction and I'll explode, but supply me with the will to survive and watch the world grow. This ain't about talking about problems, I bring solution. Where's the restitution stipulated through the Constitution? You violated, now I'm back to haunt your nights. Listen to the screams of the lives you sacrifice. And in case you don't know, ghetto born black seeds still grow. We coming back for everything you owe.
I'm coming collecting the shit that belongs to me. Motherfuckers all running and dying lean.
Not guilty on the grounds of insanity. It was them or me, busting at my innocent family. Say they looking for keys. I was home alone, blind to the prelude. Busting, talking about where is the Quaaludes. What you say, fool? Where in the hell is the search warrant? No feedback is what he uttered. Before we scream, nigga, motherfucker, drop me to my knees. I proceed to flee, suffering the rain of blows to my hands and knees. Will I survive? Is God watching? I grab his bat and bust in self-defense, my only option. God damn. Now they got me going to the county jail, and my family can't pay this outrageous bail. Trying to offer me a deal, they told me if I swear, move me and my people to a mansion in Brazil, blind me. So this is how it ends, no friends. I'll be stressed and they just repossess my bins. Told the judge it was self-defense, but he won't listen. So I'm bumping this in federal prison, giving everything I owe.
I'm collecting the shit that belongs to me. Motherfuckers are running and ducking. I'm a crazy nigga on a mission. We the bad mentality, army missiles, guns, grenades. Pull out the pin, free. I'm coming collecting the shit that belongs to me. Motherfuckers are running and ducking. I'm a crazy nigga on a mission. We the bad mentality, army missiles, guns, grenades. Pull out the pin, free. I'm coming, coming.
I want to stop and talk about something you brought up, which I find really fascinating. So Freddie Gray was murdered by the police in 2015 in Baltimore, which, as you said, kicked off a rebellion. This happened like a year after Ferguson erupted. So this was, you know, national news, huge, huge thing. You already kind of got into this, but how did the police kind of respond to that, either in terms of counterinsurgency, or the picture you paint is that they benefited basically from the image of them as these like embattled police that were trying to do good, or, you know, these evil protesters were making them look bad. So I'm just curious, in your estimation, what impact did that have and how did the police respond to it?
Yeah, so I guess the caveat I want to throw is, like, while I'm saying this was the result or the sort of calculated response to the police to an uprising, this is not to say that an uprising is not a worthwhile endeavor just because the police exploited it. But what basically happened was, you know, we had this uprising that lasted about 2 weeks. It kind of peaked with some, you know, serious property damage, some buildings being burned. And that became the sort of prevailing image of Baltimore. So you have both sort of the fear of what that looks like for Baltimore in sort of a public relations way, and the fear of it happening again, or sort of showing, you know, I spoke earlier about the segregation. I mean, one of the things that's really powerful about the uprising here was that people were marching, and the marches all were sort of began in Freddie Gray's community in Gilmore Homes in Sandtown, a neighborhood in Baltimore. And so these marches then were going through the whole town. So some of the sort of perceived barriers that are, and I don't mean to sound like I'm not overestimating this. Parts of the city where it's just understood that young black people especially are not allowed to go, suddenly they're going there because they're marching, and they're often marching with, you know, clergy and art students and other people that sort of are allowed to traverse the city without being overly policed. And so that kind of segregation was broken down in those 2 weeks by daily protests. And then another level is kind of another is breached because then suddenly there's property damage, which obviously is when the people in charge get really scared. At the same time, and you saw this in Ferguson too, this myth of the so-called Ferguson effect, which is there's increases in crime, and then that's blamed on an uprising. In Baltimore, for reasons that are still kind of hard to fully understand, there was a big uptick in homicides not long after the uprising here. And so then you had this thing where the police felt like they had to get control of the city. And the easiest way to do that was to sort of leverage this homicide rate on the city and be like, now we're known as a city of property damage and homicides. And they sort of allowed police to police more, especially because you had this myth among certain cops, among certain people and sort of, you know, thinkers, liberal thinkers, that the police were so frustrated by the uprising and so offended by it, they're not even policing anymore. And so in response, these sort of specialized units like the task force and other ones were encouraged to go harder and more aggressively. There's a moment in the book that is described in a police meeting in July of 2015 where a commander in charge of these plainclothes squads basically says, you know, go out there and get what you need to get done, however you need to do it. And that's an account that comes from a former police officer. So that was sort of the strategy. And that's the counterinsurgent strategy, is like, go after everybody. And so they use this moment of like light reform to sort of leverage again. So anytime there's a reform suggested, they just say, hey, well, the homicide rate's high. I expect us to police if now we have to do it. You know, we have to do body cameras. You know, what if I'm in a situation I have to turn my body camera on? All these talking points about anti-reform that we heard, they really weaponized them against the city and used them to fight reforms and claim that reforms didn't work. So even just the simple criticism of police was used as an example of like, hey, look, you criticize the police and then, you know, there's more violence because the city's out of control. And so there's kind of that tension there that they use between the sort of public facing talks about, you know, what did we learn from this uprising, and police that really saw it as a moment to reclaim power and, as I think, really punish the city, really go after Black Baltimore and say, hey, you're not going to do that again. You're going to sort of flood your community with plainclothes cops like these dirty cops, and we're going to harass you into submission.
Well, we've talked a lot about the cops selling drugs. Explain to us how that works.
Yeah, so one way to think of it is, like, as I kind of said, as we have this stance that, hey, we need to be sort of kinder to people who use drugs, but we still got to stop crimes, need to focus on guns. It really did a thing where by the sort of around the uprising time, 2015, the timeline of my book, you didn't get the same kind of accolades you got for seizing a bunch of drugs as you used to. You know, you kind of have these cliche images we all know of, like a table full of seized drugs in which the police are saying, hey, we seized all these drugs, we did a great job. I think by the, even in Baltimore and other places, we start to see through that a little bit. And so the focus comes on guns. You literally see a switch to police start to say, hey, we seized all these guns yesterday. We're doing a good job. Now, why that matters is then the drugs become less interesting to the police commanders, which means they're less and less interesting to prosecutors who are trying to charge gun arrests and gun charges now. And it makes the drugs easier to steal. Now, how this theft happens is you have this sort of, I think, petty pocket surfing theft of you stop people, you throw them against the wall, you see what they got. If they got anything, you keep it. If they don't, you throw them on their way, or if they just have a gun, you arrest them. Then you have the bigger ones. Like I said, they're also being working as part of this kind of task force. They're being given information on the kind of quote-unquote bad guys with guns who, of course, as long as the drug war exists, there's going to be a direct correlation between people that are involved in illegal activity and selling drugs. It's incredibly lucrative, obviously. And so you have this thing where they're then being given intel on specific targets they're supposed to investigate. And often those are big-time drug dealers. And so then what they're doing is they're getting to those guys and they're stealing parts of the drugs because they're stopping them. And in the beginning of the book, in chapter one, there's kind of this very important robbery that they do that matters because it kind of helps lead to their downfall, without spoiling too much. But, you know, they stop this guy in the middle of a cocaine deal that they knew about. They presented it as sort of a random stop. Oh, we just stopped him because he was idling on a one-way street. He was obstructing traffic. That was kind of their claim. They then get into his car while he's doing a drug deal, which they knew was going to happen. He has 2 kilograms on him. They arrest him for that. They get his keys. They break into his house with his keys, or they get into his house with his keys illegally. They then go into his basement, and he has a fridge, like a mini fridge full of kilos, has 10 kilograms of cocaine in it. They steal 2. They hand in 8, and they have a bunch of guns. And he also has $200,000 in cash, and they steal $100,000. So in the end of the day, with this one guy, they steal 2 kilograms of cocaine, $100,000 in cash, and they're still handing in 8 kilograms and another $100,000 in cash. So it seems like a pretty good bust, you know? What then happens is that those 2 kilograms are sent over to a drug dealer who then deals them and then splits the money with, in this case, Jenkins. At the same time, you have another cop who's eventually part of this group named Momenu Ganda, who's a black cop. Jenkins is white, which is kind of important to think about, this kind of county-city tension. Gondo is working with a heroin-dealing crew that he grew up with, and he's essentially providing them with some protection and some information. He's not exactly helping them deal drugs, but he's certainly preventing them from getting caught, and he's also often telling them about like investigations and things, and then he's getting some kind of profit off of that, whether it's through connecting dealers or just the protection. So you have those two guys are dealing drugs in very different ways. One is facilitating a kind of conventional group of people dealing drugs, and the other one is sort of a complicated robbery scheme in which he's taking drugs from drug dealers, giving to his drug dealer friend, who's then selling them. And then what ends up happening eventually is that Jenkins starts to get more and more drugs and needs more people to deal them, that because he's stealing so many that he brings in one of the other cops in the squad, Ram, who's like sort of hard up for cash, and gets Ram to sell some cocaine and heroin that he's been stealing to another cop in Philly. So then the conspiracy actually extends out to a Philadelphia cop who facilitated a drug deal as well. So basically, through the theft of the drugs and the sort of strategy of handing in some of the drugs and keeping other parts of the drugs, they kind of are able to build this sort of constant flow of drug dealing that's they're then just keeping this money for themselves, oftentimes buying sort of things off the books or you know, in doing the book, they all have pretty nice decks, I noticed, when I drove by their houses. You know, things like that, that they would sort of use it for these little things. And then we're sort of gathering more and more cash through drug dealing. And again, I would stress, there is a long history of drug dealing in the Baltimore Police Department. So they're not the only ones that were doing it, but it's sort of a perfect storm of multiple cops that have connections to dope dealers that are willing to use those connections to sort of sell and move a lot of stolen drugs.
At this point in the discussion, I feel it's imperative to ask the question maybe a lot of people are thinking is that, and I'm sure they already know the answer to this, but where are the checks and balances, so to speak, in this? You know, who's watching this? You know, is there any oversight? Is anybody, while this is happening, asking any questions. The picture you paint, as you said earlier, was that, you know, this was this warrior cop that was doing all this great stuff, supposedly, for the department. So people were kind of looking the other way. And, you know, there's obviously the blue coat of silence. So I'm curious, how did it get to the point that they were indicted? We'll kind of talk more about that a little bit. But did they get in trouble along the way, or was it basically just a clear ride until they messed up?
So what would happen is, I mean, this is a really good example of like the problems with reform or the problems with police investigating police, is like there were occasional complaints about these officers, but those complaints are hard to do. I mean, it's kind of a brilliant scheme, because you have this thing where you arrest someone and you steal from them, but they also generally committed something that we consider a crime. So it shouldn't be this way, but they're not deemed as sympathetic, or they're already being charged with something that can sort of be parlayed into something valid. And so it's really hard if you're, say, charged with a gun or you're charged with some cocaine to in any way complain and say, again, like I mentioned earlier, like you can't then say, hey, actually had more cocaine than I was arrested with. They stole some of it. So there's that kind of protection they had. And then that at the same time, I think because, as you said, these officers were getting a lot of arrests and seizing a lot of guns, there was a real tendency to not question how they did it. And again, this sort of dehumanization of people who use drugs or people who deal drugs, or even just people operating in a underground economy in a deindustrialized city, is such that like it just kind of didn't matter to a lot of people in power that this was happening. What you then also have, though, is you have examples where internal affairs tried to get involved and were sort of either stopped or threatened, even you know, there's a lot of problems with internal affairs. Again, the idea of police investigating their police is really limiting. But speaking to a couple of people involved in internal affairs, they would often investigate this and see some of this and then sort of provide a report and a suggestion, including like firing some of these officers for different things they did. And then they're sort of someone high up would intervene and be like, let's sort of slap them on the wrist instead. Really famously, both as a story at the time and now as sort of a weird kind of maybe in a point where this could have been stopped by police, was that in 2014, Jenkins, the main cop, was involved in planting cocaine on someone that was a cocaine dealer. He was following this guy around. He stopped the guy and got into his car. There was no drugs in the car. He knew the guy was a cocaine dealer. He then had another officer break into that guy's house, bring the cocaine to the van, and put the cocaine in the van, and then charge the guy with the cocaine. So what happens with this case and why it's important is that the whole thing is essentially captured on a security camera from a gas station. So when this goes to trial, or is about to go to trial, and this guy is charged with cocaine, they are able to look at the difference between what the sort of claim on the probable cause, which is we stopped Mr. Price and, you know, we got into his car and, you know, we found the cocaine. And then people watch the video security camera footage of the arrest, and they see that, like, in fact, this guy was stopped for hours. There's lots of people coming and going. So anyway, there's kind of something almost like evidence that they did this in this case. That's sort of their MO again, like break into your house, do what they need to do. Mr. Walter Price, the person accused in this case, later is killed in mysterious circumstances that I also haven't been able to figure out, that comes up in the book a little bit. But Price at the time is then also given immunity. And he basically testifies, I was a cocaine dealer, but I didn't have the cocaine in my van that morning. They stuck it in there. That goes into a serious internal affairs investigation. What comes out of it is basically, hey, he's a good cop. This guy's a bad guy who deals drugs. Let's just give Jenkins a slap on the wrist and keep it moving. And so that's kind of an extreme example. But you see this with these officers. The rare times where they were caught, they then were often protected, or just sort of the in the same way that, you know, on a national level, we see how many officers are then charged with, the rare moments where we have an officer charged with a homicide for a police killing, and then how often they get off. It's kind of a version of that with theft and another crime. So that's kind of what happens, is basically they're protected, and also because they're creating a lot of arrests and making the department look good, they're allowed to get away with this.
Can you explain to us how high up did this corruption go And this might take some explaining of how the police hierarchy worked, both in terms of, like, how high up were people aware that this was going on, and how high up were people basically benefiting either monetarily or through any means from this corruption?
Right, yes. Yeah. So there is the sense that you kind of said as well that, like, it seems inarguable to me that people as high up as the commissioner knew something was going on. And the sort of most generous reading I can give to someone like a police commissioner who was in charge of the department and therefore in charge of these officers would have been that they decided to willingly look the other way. I mean, the thing you hear a lot is, like, any person that wanted to would have started to question these arrests just because, like, there's just not a constitutional way to be seizing as many guns and as much drugs as these guys were doing. It's just like that those numbers they produced were just impossible to do constitutionally. So there is that, at least on the level that you, the generous reading would be that command, lieutenants and commissioners looked the other way. What we do know is that at least some commanders helped this in the case I just mentioned about the planting the cocaine. A commander named Daryl D'Souza kind of helped Jenkins get out of that a little bit and sort of said, hey, be nice to him. D'Souza was later federally charged for lying on his taxes and things that are kind of adjacent to the Gun Trace Task Force scandal. So there's that. And then there's just at the same time, though, just the sense that you give these guys a long leash and you kind of let them do what you want. As long as they're getting results, you don't question it too much. Now, what you also have, though, is you have other sergeants other than Jenkins. So, you know, sergeant is a pretty high up rank in the department that have been indicted. Another sergeant of this task force before Jenkins, Thomas Allers, was indicted. And then another sergeant who was kind of seen as Jenkins' mentor, this guy named Keith Gladstone, was also indicted. Gladstone was indicted for helping Jenkins plant a gun on someone after Jenkins had run the guy over. So basically ran this guy over. And then he called his buddy Gladstone and said, hey, I need you to bring a gun to throw on this guy so I can justify running him over. So Gladstone has been indicted. In total, there is now 15 indictments. It started at 7, then there was an 8th in 2017, and then since then about 8 others have been indicted. So it's sort of ongoing. The highest ranking that has been actually charged criminally has only been fellow sergeants. So that's kind of I'm kind of walking a line here because I can't. Like, it's not the problem with and when the book was lawyered, there's sort of things you might know or think about people you just can't publish. But my sense is that there is no way to have been operating an above the board police department, whatever that even means, and not to have known that these guys were, doing some of this, or that at least they weren't on the up and up.
So let's switch a little bit here. What was the impact of all this corruption and criminal activity on the part of the police, on the communities they policed? I mean, what's the human cost?
Yeah, so you have people that were either arrested for absolutely no justifiable reason at all, or were arrested illegally, and then did time for things they shouldn't have done time for, because even if they supposedly had a gun or drugs, the arrest itself was illegal in one way or another. The one way to think of it is let's just start with the 7. So you have initially 7 police officers that have all been in the department and all committing crimes for a decade or so, at least before that. And you have 7 of those officers with a decade's worth of arrests behind them. And you sort of keep, if you kind of think of it that way, and you think of how many people they're arresting with each other or with other police officers, you sort of get this exponential amount of cases that are now questioned. The Public Defender's Office of Baltimore, which was really kind of a little bit onto these guys before they were indicted. We can talk about that in a second. But the Public Defender's Office believed that up to 20 to 30,000 cases were compromised. You're thinking of 20 to 30,000 people in Baltimore over a span of a decade or so that shouldn't be in jail or shouldn't have been in jail that were. So that's sort of the big picture cost. But what you see individually is you have people whose lives were ruined. There's a couple who were essentially kidnapped after they were at a Home Depot. The cops followed them to the Home Depot, kidnapped them, took them to their house, and then stole $20,000 from them, didn't arrest them for anything. What you hear in that story is that that caused a lot of actual trauma and tension for that family. The wife said that she didn't feel comfortable being in the house without her husband anymore, so that, like, there's kind of this direct example of terror. The robberies also create a lot of violence. If you think about there's one person in the book named Davon Robinson who was robbed for $10,000 by these cops.
He was robbed in April of 2016. He then is arrested for the gun. $10,000 is stolen from him. He then owes that $10,000 to someone because he was a drug dealer. He then has an arraignment for the gun charge in early July of 2016. After he leaves the arraignment for the gun charge, he drives to see his kid. He's followed from court by someone he owes money to, and he's shot and killed in front of his child for owing $10,000. $10,000 he didn't have because the police stole it from him. So there is an example where you have where it's like the police didn't literally shoot and kill Davon Robinson, but their actions and their theft of his money led directly to his inability to pay someone who then killed him over it. And if you start to think of what I described earlier, that you have dozens and dozens of these kind of sort of robberies on the nightly basis, you just can't imagine. It's sort of hard to think of its effect on crime. You know, how many shootings, how many murders are tied to retaliatory violence because the drug dealer these cops robbed couldn't pay their plug. And then lastly, one of my most extreme examples is the day-to-day harassment and terror and disenfranchising of people that were caught up in this is they targeted violence interrupters, which, you know, like kind of people in the community. They're often formerly incarcerated returning citizens whose job it is to sort of help mediate violence. They arrested these guys and harassed them because kind of the whole function of a violence interrupter is, you know, the community, you know who's doing the violence, you're trying to stop it. But your whole premise of that is you don't tell the police. Well, they didn't like that. So they would go up to people who are returning citizens that are trying to stop violence in communities in like restorative justice ways, push them for information, and then when they didn't get that information, arrest them or drop a gun on them. We also, me and my co-writer did an Intercept story specifically about harassing violence interrupters. But that's another thing where you want to think about like the impact is like they're causing violence and causing shootings through their robberies. And then they're also taking the people who are trying to productively and restoratively eliminate violence off the street and putting them in jail. One guy, LeVar Mullen, who was a returning citizen, was charged with a gun that he says was planted on him. And he did 3.5 years of federal time and was in jail from 2014 when he's illegally arrested until about a month or two after these cops were indicted, and he was only let out after that.
I mean, we could do a whole thing on that too. I mean, we've talked about this before, but I mean, there's this really, really historical classic case that's talked about in Can't Stop, Won't Stop, the history of the hip hop generation. I'm sure you've read this book, by Jeff Chang. But it talks about in the LA rebellion, there was the historic, gang truce that happened right before the rebellion, kicked off, and the police basically targeted like barbecues and unity events that the gangs put on to squash, inner violence in the Los Angeles area because they thought that they were coming together to attack and kill police officers. But also I would probably argue that they wanted to secure their jobs and they wanted people to continue to fight and kill each other. So they had a justification for existing. I don't know. Also too, just on this idea of police targeting, violence interrupters, Vice has put out over the past like 2 years, just a really fantastic kind of look at these different, programs. Like I think the last one was like paintballs up, guns down. And there's a lot of different kind of variations. We ran an article last year about, water guns up, guns down, and stuff like that. But there's been all these kind of attempts in different cities, Atlanta, other cities, to kind of like people come together and they play games, like whether it's water guns or paintball guns, or people will do like BMX or motorsports and stuff like that to try to like get people from different neighborhoods to hang out, but also to encourage people not to engage in violence and stuff like that. And they've largely been targeted by the police. I think another one Vice did a story on was one about like a boxing club that brought people together. I don't know what the city was. It might have been Chicago, but it was targeted by the police and harassed. But similar thing, that they would specifically harass people that are engaging in this thing, which I think everybody can agree is like not only like a good wholesome activities, but like physically trying to stop violence in certain neighborhoods.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought up Jeff Chang's book, and also some of that sort of gang truce attacks on gang troops by police. Vicky Osterwald's book, In Defense of Looting, has a bit about that too. I was really excited when I read that book to see some of that come back up, because I think people don't always think about that. But yeah, there's these, I mean, the way to look at it is this, the way it also sanitizes some of these defund and abolish conversations is that, you know, these violence interrupters are shown by hard data to be very effective. And so they are really an existential threat for police officers who are not able to curb violence, especially in Baltimore with the degree of success that violence interrupters have. We have a big dirt bike community that's like bikes up, guns down. And I've written a lot about this in the past, but the police here there was a dirt bike task force that specifically went after young black men that were dirt biking together on Sundays, because technically you can't do that in the city lines. But that also, Jenkins, the sort of cop, the main cop in the book, was also apparently stealing dirt bikes and reselling them and things like that. So they had their hands in all these things. But yeah, that when there is a community response to violence, or a community response to fixing that doesn't involve the police are motivated to destroy it, even if it's successful, or especially because it's successful, because then it's an existential threat to their jobs and their money.
How were these people finally caught? I mean, they were caught, they were indicted. What happened? Was there like a pivotal moment? Did something catch up with them? Were they exposed by the media? How did they end up becoming indicted?
So the sort of short version, and I'm going to give you the short version because I think the long version is it's long, but also I think it's bullshit. I think it's BS. I think that the version that the federal government put out doesn't exactly make sense. But the short version, which it is true, is that the federal government backdoored their way into finding out about this police corruption. What they were doing was they were investigating overdoses of white folks in Baltimore and Harford County outside Baltimore City, and they were trying to connect those overdoses back to drugs that were sold to then do the incredibly fraught policy of charging drug dealers with homicides for quote-unquote causing overdoses. So what happens is they're looking at this heroin dealing crew because they've traced their dope back to them that's led to an overdose of a white girl who died right before Christmas, kind of your classic quote-unquote opioid crisis tragedy, white girl dies before Christmas. In the process of tracing this heroin back to its source, they stumble upon a group of heroin dealers in East Baltimore. When they're investigating those heroin dealers, they get their phones tapped, and through that, this cop I mentioned before, Gondo, is heard talking to them. So then they realize that a cop is involved. They get a tap on Gondo's phone, and they realize he's involved in robberies with some other cops. And then when he joins Jenkins' squad, they then have a wiretap on Gondo's phone that's just exposing more and more robberies. So the federal government kind of fell into this police corruption case the way doing the thing they love to do, which is, you know, prosecute young black men for dealing drugs and enforcing the drug war. So it kind of starts there. I bring what I said about being questionable is then there's claims that, they kind of stumbled upon some of this, and that, that one of the officers involved in the unit was never charged at all, and they said he was clean. I want to kind of hold off on presenting any of that because I just don't buy. I think there's a lot about the story they're not telling us, but I do think the core of it is that they were investigating drug dealers. They stumbled upon a drug dealing cop and got to other cops and then had to sort of, enforce it, because the sort of parallel narrative of this police scandal is a sort of workaday, and I think, in my opinion, like really fraught drug charge investigation. I mean, the drug dealers that were working with Cop Gondo got the same amount of time in jail, 25 years, as the Jenkins did. And the idea that a cop who's dealing drugs, planting evidence, doing all this, gets the same as someone involved in a basic heroin dealing conspiracy says a lot about our justice system. So that's kind of the general gist of it. The other side of it, I would say, is that the book, for a number of reasons, we really didn't want this book to look at, we didn't want this to be the story about the good cops who stopped the bad cops, because I think that's kind of misunderstands the nature of the story, you know? But, so we focus on defense attorneys that were representing a lot of the people that had their lives destroyed, whether that was because they were dealing drugs or were alleged to be dealing drugs. But the defense attorneys were the ones who started to hear from their clients that were saying,
hey, look, they stole a bunch of cash from me, or they're lying about the entire nature of this stop. And so our book really looks at how defense attorneys were able to help expose this and further support the FBI case against these dirty cops that the FBI, as I said, kind of stumbled into, whereas defense attorneys really, especially in Baltimore, they really dedicate huge parts of their practice to trying to expose dirty cops. So they were able to kind of parlay that information to the FBI, and that really solidified this corruption case against them. So it's kind of like, to us, it's like the defense attorneys are the heroes, not the DOJ.
Well, I drive out in the night, never come back in a mind of fright. Stay out longer while I can, picking fossils in the sand. I admire all the games, another asshole lights the flame. Rusted clotheslines in the sun, noise control I've sunk in. I will smile the greatest red and smile, no one to complain. Red and in chrome and gore, it's all the same.
So what happened to these officers? Did they end up doing jail time? Did they just, you know, get a slap on the wrist?
So the initial seven are in jail currently. Their sentences vary from like 5 to 7 years. So in Jenkins' case, is 25 years. Herschel and Taylor, the two cops that didn't plead guilty, that went to trial, each got 18 years. And then other cops involved since then have also pretty much pled guilty because, like, there's really no way you're getting out of this. Like, there's just too much insurmountable evidence against you with all these wiretaps and body camera footage and all these things they're able to use. And so, all the cops are currently in jail in federal prison. Jenkins, the mastermind, is in for 25 years. It was a very weird thing covering the trial, especially because some people there were very, very excited to hear a cop get a lot of time in jail, and like, as someone who doesn't think jail is should really exist, I was sort of conflicted with seeing that, hey, it's good that these cops at least suffered some kind of consequences for their actions, but it's kind of not enough and never will be enough. And I'd also add that back in 2006 there was two Baltimore cops King and Murray, who were doing similar things, stealing drugs, redealing them, protecting drug dealers. And those officers each got a combined 400 years in jail. So there's also a way in which, like, even compared to what the symbolic, you know, whatever the symbolism of the sentencing is, that Jenkins sort of actually got off light, even though I think he's really causing a just obscene amount of chaos and tragedy in the city. But yeah, all of them are currently in jail, as are their kind of drug conspirators, who some of whom cooperated and some of whom didn't.
So just to kind of step back and look at this thing in connection to other departments, is police corruption like this common? I don't know if you can answer this, but I mean, obviously, like, before we started recording, we were talking about other departments in Oakland, Los Angeles, you know, there are other examples, but I mean, is this type of stuff common where officers are basically getting together and benefiting from the people that they're busting on the street?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly common. I think that the Gun Trace Task Force that this book is about are maybe exceptionally corrupt. I mean, just the fact that you have three different cops all stealing and dealing drugs to separate people, the way that it was sort of involved a lot of cops, and, you know, it sort of goes on for a long time. It's maybe exceptional in terms of its scope and its how it was organized, but I think that I believe what you're seeing in every city is some more scaled down version of this, which is police stealing from people that are soldiers in the drug war and stealing their money or stealing their drugs and redealing it. One really crazy thing I think about is speaking to police a lot for this book, actually, to try to understand how some of the policing stuff works on a sort of, you know, infrastructural level. I heard this thing 80-10-10, which I used to hear back when I, like, managed a bookstore, which is, you know, 80% of your employees are really sort of in middle of the road and are going to be swayed one way or another by the person in charge. 10% of your employees are, you know, sort of, you know, unimpeachably good, and 10% are going to always steal. This is like how they, like, sort of, when I worked at Border, this is how it's kind of like pushed into your head about, like, shrink and things like that. But I heard this 80-10-10 stuff by police. And if you think about that in and of itself, a police, like, the way a police think about their departments is that 10% are right off the bat corrupt. And so I think that that's the way to think of it. So there's no way this isn't happening. And that specifically these plainclothes units that we're talking about are just really susceptible to this corruption, because they're not out there answering calls. They're not out there sort of walking the beat or the things that, you know, at least in your head, they're sort of conventional police activities, if you think there should be any, if there should be any police at all. But what these guys are doing is looking for crime, doing investigations. And so when you have these cops that are given a really long leash, are kind of told to, like, wage war or wage a counterinsurgency against citizens, and you're told, telling them to go out there and get the bad guys, you're putting them every day in situations where they are going to see a bunch of drugs and a lot of cash, and it's really hard to imagine why you wouldn't steal some of that. And especially if you then have all this sort of propaganda in your head that these drug dealers are bad people, and then you start to really be like, well, you know, I could use $10,000 more than this bad drug dealer. I think those kind of things are really common in departments. Theft is definitely used as a way to build trust in multiple departments. And theft is also a way to then prevent other people from ratting on you, because you also then have stolen with them and you can sort of get them caught up in it. Yeah, and I mean, there are kind of extreme examples of this. You mentioned the LA County Sheriff's Department, which really does seem to be operating a gang, in which there were even initiation killings. There's the Oakland Riders you mentioned earlier before we were talking. The Rampart scandal in LA, which is really similar from back in the day. Earlier in this year, a Patterson police sergeant named Michael Cheff was charged with theft, stealing from drug dealers and allowing his squad to do it. So that's kind of exactly a micro version of the task force scandal. And then this kind of big discussion right now we're having about police in Nigeria, the SARS, the sort of anti-robbery squad, which are essentially a plainclothes counterinsurgency unit, maybe on another level than the American versions, but doing the same kind of stuff. So I think that kind of big scope scandals happening elsewhere, but also this sort of workaday plainclothes police waging war on communities also enables them to steal cash, especially, I think.
I want to ask now, and I think a lot of people listening to this that consider themselves abolitionists would say at this point, wow, this is horrible, this sucks, but I mean, yeah, we want to abolish these institutions. Like, what's the point of pointing out police corruption? I'm curious, you know, from an abolitionist perspective, when you look at this story, does this poke any holes in major police narratives? Like, does this, like, advance the conversation around abolition in a certain way? Because a lot of people would just say, like, you know, these are literally the bad apples in the barrel. Like, we can just take these out, obviously. Like, what does this mean for the abolitionist movement in terms, like, when we look at these really egregious cases? I mean, because some people would say, like, well, they got indicted. Like, they're gone now. This guy's doing 25 years in prison. Like, the system works.
Yeah, that's a great question because, I mean, I think that one problem with the book in that it's very focused on this group is that you might come out of it thinking about this bad apples myth. I mean, I hope that the book, and I hope that I articulated here that, like, there are clearly a lot of other officers that were implicated. As I said during the trial, about 12 others were named overtly. There's other cops these guys are working with that are currently on the force, are able to quietly resign. And so I hope that the book gives you a scope, it gives you a sense of how this was normalized and how that normalization of this and how this is central to how police operate was just simply exploited in a more exceptional way by this task force. But on a big level, I think the most important thing in terms of thinking about abolition is that the Gun Trace Task Force is a great example of how reform doesn't work. You know, after Freddie Gray's death, you have a Department of Justice investigation into the Baltimore Police Department for civil rights. While the Civil Rights Department of Obama's DOJ is investigating this police department, the Gun Trace Task Force is doing what it's doing. So literally the federal government is here to look for this kind of corruption and look for this and didn't see any of it. So I think that's a huge argument against, like, Obama era reforms. You know, the Baltimore Police Department introduced body cameras in response to Freddie Gray's death. All the sort of classic, here's how we fix police, were introduced here. And what you see in this book and what you see with these cops is how they exploited every reform. They would not wear their body cameras. They faked body camera footage. They would record something and then record it again. They would, I still get information about this case even after the book came out. There's an example I saw where one of the people we spoke to for the book who was beaten up by these cops, like, really brutally, like, his face was, like, really bruised. He said that, they then, put a camera on him and made him say that, you know, they didn't do any of that he fell. That's why his face is all beat up and bruised. The cops didn't do anything about it. And so that's an example where they're using body camera. They turn their body camera on before they turn on. They tell this guy, here's what you're going to say, and maybe we'll not kick your ass some more. And so what you see with these officers is they exploited the reforms because they found ways to use them for criminality. And for the most part, as, like, even the ACLU on down has pointed out, body cameras are more apt to get you in trouble than exonerate you, although occasionally they've been very successful in showing cops doing bad stuff. But overall, they're much more used as a prosecutorial tool. And in this case, they were used to falsify evidence and further protect. And then on a bigger level, the reforms were, at the same time as they were sort of squashed or sort of reimagined for how they could help police, they were used again for the police to argue, hey, how are we supposed to do our jobs? You know, if we have to, you know, like, if we have to honor the Fourth Amendment all the time, well, we just can't stop the degree of crime. And so, and then you have a lot of people who are deeply sympathetic to that. There's just not a lot of people, including, that's not just like a right wing thing. Plenty of liberals in Baltimore are really sympathetic to this idea that, like, yeah, if we hamstring these cops more and they can't, you know, go out there and get the job done, the city's just going to go to hell. It's just like, you know, that's how it is. And, you know, there's been pieces, in the Atlantic and New York Magazine that really argue these points about Baltimore specifically. So what I think the big picture here for abolitionists is that this is just such a great example of how reforms don't work. If Baltimore was sort of really put in a lot of reforms, if Baltimore charged officers with the death of Freddie Gray, and while all that's happening, these cops are doing that, doing what they're doing in this book, it's really hard to imagine that reforms are really going to shake police officers. And then the other side of that is if police are going to publicly cry in reforms while also doing all this kind of behavior, there's just no reason to not push for more serious and intense things like defund or abolish. It's not like the police came in and were like, hey, you know, fair enough. We understand we need to wear body cameras now. And I understand, you know, we need to, like, be policing constitutionally. It's not like the police concede on these sort of more reforms that are introduced in the Obama era anymore anyway. And so there's not a lot of I don't think there's a lot of motivation by abolitionists, especially, to even give any sort of serious thought to compromising, because the police don't want, you know, police have been fighting against chokeholds right now, things that are really basic that wouldn't be hard for police to put into practice. So there's just no evidence that reforms work. And I just think that, again, this task force is a great example of what happens when reforms are put into place and how they can use and exploit those reforms for sympathy by the public, and then also, as I said, to literally kind of use the technology and the language of reform to continue to commit crimes.
Yeah, and especially when, I mean, as we opened with, you know, the real kind of egregious stuff is also just in the structural nature of policing itself. I mean, how it basically enforces all of these inequalities. You know, it enforces, you know, where people can go, this sort of racial apartheid, enforces this, you know, generational, deep, deep set poverty, all this, like, institutional violence in different levels. I mean, to me, that's the thing. I mean, you know, you look at this, it's just so clear that this is such a part of that and such, like, an institutional way of enforcing these systems based on violence. And of course, you know, that's the legal stuff. Like, that, you know, those are, you know, that's how the system is supposed to be.
I think the thing I really try to stress is that what the Gun Trace Task Force was doing in Baltimore and what these other examples we kind of cited, whether it's LA County or Oakland or Rampart in the early 90s, what they're all doing is just they're the logical extension of policing as we know it and for the most part accept it. Like, you can sit down with pretty much, I mean, one benefit of this book rhetorically is that it's very weird, but a lot of, like, for example, police officers have come up and said they read it and are really upset by it and all that because, you know, no one's going to defend these guys, right? Like, it's egregious. But when you start to really say, no, they just exploited what was already happening with police and what has always been happening with police and how they operate, they just sort of took it to another level. I think that's the takeaway here, is that this kind of, when you tell police officers that are at war with the citizens, when you literally use terms like the drug war or the war on guns, or there was sort of intelligence gathering within this department that's called the war room, where they would literally say, today you're going after this guy, it makes sense that you start to see the citizens as, you know, combatants in a war, and then they become dehumanized and become easier to steal from or rob or harm in all these different ways. And so I think that this task force is the logical extension of what we want police strategy to be. And as we're seeing, again, not that it started with Trump, but as Trump sort of takes the mask off, even the sort of quasi respectability of we need to respect the police or these law and order rhetoric, you see how this is what policing is. It is harassing people, it is ruining lives, and it is enforcing these barriers and to keep their jobs and maintain power and limit reforms, which, you know, give them less power.
Yeah, let me ask you one other question. I mean, I think one of the fascinating things that you're arguing is that, you know, this in itself is in response to reforms. And, I mean, over the past couple of months, we've seen, you know, this historic uprising across the country. I think it's been interesting, too, because it's also been marked by seemingly, you know, a real aversion by the system to offer up any sort of, you know, structural or any sort of, you know, concessions to people beyond, like, certain officers getting fired or facing charges and stuff like that. I guess my question is, you know, what do you see for the future of policing, and do you see any, like, trajectories playing out in a certain direction, kind of based around some of the same similar stuff we've been saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I do see is that, you know, let's take Biden, which, you know, I certainly not excited about a Biden presidency, but pragmatically, I think it's probably better than a Trump presidency. I'm not saying vote for Biden, do whatever you want, but I think that's kind of clear. But when Biden talks about police, and that's to put even the aside being that he's his vice president is a prosecutor who have long been worked directly with police and rely on the police to prosecute people. So they rely on believing the police or
help selling the lies of police to put people in jail. Well, you have someone like Biden, even you have a person who wants to give the police more money and thinks that these reforms that I kind of show that police just kind of exploit and take advantage of are what that's his solution. So what I think is you'll have this sort of ongoing tension that we've had before. And the best you can dodge is that perhaps the sort of unadulterated fascism of Trump, if he loses, will maybe give us a moment, but to reimagine it. But what we're going to really just see is a moment to catch our breath in terms of trying to push for serious change to police, because Biden and Harris are certainly not going to – they're going to repeat the stories that this book shows. I mean, that's one thing that I think is – notable is, like, I think because we had this uprising here in Baltimore and we saw the sort of party lines drawn afterwards and how police exploited it and how politicians exploited it and kind of mixed it with the right sort of reformer or like woke language, that we kind of saw what's happened in the past 6 months or so on back in 2015, 2016. And we also saw what can happen when you don't put a leash on the cops or when you don't really seriously question them. So I think that it kind of means that the debate becomes more nuanced, maybe, and that might be good in terms of pushing for change. But I worry that what we're going to really face. I'm stalling because I'm trying to find some way to leave room with something more positive. But I guess I just can't really do that. I mean, I think that like the debate will continue even under a Biden presidency, and that he believes that, you know, you can tell the cops. Here's how to look at it. I'm sorry. Here's how to look at it. Trump understands that the police are a special interest group, and you need to appeal to that special interest group and kiss their ass, because they, in this case, they'll literally protect you. Like, imagine if we have this poll watching chaos of the election. It's not like police are going to stop Proud Boys or white supremacists from harassing people. It's not how the police work. We've seen over and over again, they only do that to activists that are opposing them. And so Biden, in contrast, still believes at all that police are public servants. And Harris does too. So he kind of tries to talk about the police as if they're public servants that are undervalued or under-resourced or just need new training, as if, you know, it's the same as any other kind of technocratic fix. And so I think that's the tension, is that Trump understands and exploits the fact that the police are someone that you can use as a special interest group and they will ride with you. Biden still is under the illusion that this is something that actually they protect and serve. How abolitionists push Biden on that, I'm not sure. I don't believe you can really push him to the left, but Biden is going to be confronted with activists that are understand the police better than he does, and he's still looking at the police from this lens of that they're public servants, like, you know, firemen or people who pick up your trash, and they're just not.
Well, we've been talking for a while now. I really appreciate you coming on. This is really fascinating, both in terms of just looking at Baltimore as a city and, you know, the role of the police inside of that, but also this case. You know, I encourage people to check out the book. Will be linked in our show notes. Anything else you want to say about it? I noticed some people were saying, like, this is going to be turn into a movie someday. Is there any talk about that? Is there another project you have on the horizon? Where would you direct people also to follow your work in general?
Oh yeah. So we worked on a documentary based on the book at the same time as the book. So, and that documentary is completed, and it was supposed to come out last spring, but, COVID kind of messed that up. It was supposed to premiere at the Maryland Film Festival, which would really be super cool to sort of premiere it in the city that it's based on, to have the people that we spoke to show up. The documentary is really, really deeply focused on the people that were victimized. It really tells their stories, whereas the book sort of cross cuts between the cops, the lawyers that were trying to expose these cops and their victims. The movie is much more about the lawyers and the victims, which you kind of liked sort of finding another way into that story. I think a movie or something would be super cool. I think that what I really, just in talking to people about this story, is people want to keep trying to find a way to make it about good cops or how not all cops are like this. And this is a story that shows like the central rot of the police. And so I'm curious if anyone that makes movies or in Hollywood would be willing to sort of reckon with that reality of the story. In general, I follow me on Twitter at No Trivia, where I generally am tweeting and yelling about police and the limits of police reform. If you're interested more in the book, there's a website, igotamonster.com, that has the video trailer you mentioned as well and ways to buy the book. And so I'm kind of currently just sort of still processing this and picking up on a few related stories that have been coming out. I still get internal affairs files leaked to me from people about cops, and so I'm still kind of pushing to kind of show the extent and scope of this corruption in Baltimore, and therefore hopefully people understanding that it's bigger than a few bad apples.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.